Have you ever looked at like a really clear, undeniable X-ray?
Oh yeah, the kind where you don't even need a medical degree to know exactly what went wrong.
Right. You know the kind I mean.
Yeah.
You're staring at the image, there's a bone, and there's this jagged white line severing it right down the middle.
Yeah.
And the doctor just sort of taps the glowing screen with a pen and says, "Well, there's your problem. It's a broken tibia."
It is incredibly validating in a strange way,
Yeah.
right? We are practically wired to crave that kind of a binary diagnostic clarity.
Totally.
It's either broken or it's intact. It's diseased or it's healthy. The mechanism of injury is just right there, visible, and therefore the path to healing is obvious. You set the bone, you put on a cast.
Right, exactly. Okay. It's basically engineering applied to biology. But, the further you get from a simple bone fracture, the more that comforting clarity just completely
Oh, it
vanishes.
disappears entirely.
You step into the world of, say, autoimmune conditions or complex neurodevelopment or even generational trauma, and suddenly that X-ray machine is entirely useless. You are standing in a diagnostic landscape that is just incredibly murky.
Very much so.
You have overlapping symptoms, you have interventions that might fix one issue while accidentally triggering three others, and the definition of what it even means to be healed becomes highly subjective.
Yeah, you're dealing with the muddy waters of systemic illness. And when you are dealing with a complex system, the diagnosis itself often becomes a site of intense conflict.
Right. And if diagnosing a single human body is that complicated, imagine scaling that up. Imagine trying to diagnose an entire civilization, because that is exactly the journey we are going on today.
It's a massive
It
undertaking.
really is.
Yeah.
So if you're listening to this right now, maybe you're commuting or, maybe you're out for a walk and you are feeling a deep, persistent sense of exhaustion about the state of the world.
Which I think most people are.
Yeah, exactly. If you feel overwhelmed by how totally polarized and paralyzed society gets the second we try to solve a massive systemic problem, you are definitely not alone.
Not at all.
It feels like every time a culture tries to heal a historical wound or fix a broken institution, half the population starts screaming that the proposed cure is actually a poison that's going to destroy us all.
Yeah, it is a profound and very modern paralysis. We generally recognize that something in the social fabric is deeply broken, but the very mechanism of fixing it creates an entirely new war. The attempt to heal essentially becomes a new injury.
Exactly. So our mission today is a deep dive into a brand new, incredibly dense, and frankly, brilliant research paper. It was published today, actually, August 30th, 2026, by Dr. Bechara Sahili.
It's quite a read.
It really is. The title is T3, Conflict, Repair, and Non-Domination, The Political Ethics of Civilizational Healing.
Yeah, it is a monumental text. It functions as the third formal study in the author's broader project on the mechanics of civilizational healing. And I have to say, it really does not shy away from the most difficult aspects of human organization.
The stakes here are as high as they get. I mean, this document is essentially a blueprint for what happens when a society is profoundly injured and desperately needs healing. But the people inside that society entirely fundamentally disagree on how to go about it.
Right.
We are asking the ultimate question: what happens when healing cannot be consensual? Because we have this culturally ingrained idea that healing a civilization is about holding hands,
Yeah.
finding common ground, singing in harmony, and everyone eventually agreeing.
Which is a beautiful sentiment, honestly, but historically it's just inaccurate. Dr. Sahili S. paper argues forcefully that healing a civilization at a structural level is rarely about unanimous consensus.
Yeah.
It is about navigating severe, sometimes completely irreconcilable conflict without destroying each other in the process. It is about managing power when people just refuse to agree.
Okay, before we jump into the actual mechanics of how that works, we really need to set the stage for how we're going to handle this material.
Yes, that's crucial.
Because this text tackles some highly sensitive, deeply charged historical examples. We are going to be exploring the structural dynamics of everything from the civil rights movement and segregation to the horrific extremes of eugenics.
Right.
So I want to reassure you that our goal today is to impartially explore the author's theoretical framework. We aren't here to take political sides, left or right. We are just here to act as your guides through the source material to help you understand the mechanics of power, justice, and repair exactly as they are presented in this text.
And that is a vital foundation for this discussion. The author uses these historical cases analytically, like they are treated as structural models of how state power and social conflict function at their extreme.
They aren't weapons.
Exactly. They are not used as cheap political analogies to throw at contemporary opponents. If we can look at them through that clinical structural lens, the insights are just staggering.
Okay, let's unpack this from the very beginning, because before we can even begin to talk about the right way to fix a broken society, the text points out that we have to look at the ways we usually fail.
Yes.
We have to look at the two biggest traps we fall into when we try to manage conflict.
Right. So the paper introduces this foundational problem as the healing domination dilemma. Basically, whenever a society attempts to fix a systemic injury, it almost inevitably gravitates toward one of two major failure states.
Okay.
The first of these failure states is a concept the author calls harmony romanticism.
Harmony romanticism. I mean, it sounds like an art movement or maybe a really overly optimistic couples therapy retreat.
Yeah, it shares some DNA with the latter, certainly. Mm. Harmony romanticism is this pervasive, naive belief that if we just have enough dialogue, you know, enough empathy, enough stakeholder meetings, and enough open deliberation, we will eventually reconcile every serious conflict.
Right.
It treats communication as a universally sufficient remedy for systemic harm.
So it's the idea that deep down, we all want the same things, and if we just sit in a circle and talk long enough, the truth will out and we'll just hug it out.
Precisely. And the paper argues that this is not just false, it is structurally dangerous.
Why dangerous?
Because harmony romanticism completely ignores material antagonism. It ignores organized power, and it completely ignores bad faith actors. But most importantly, it ignores the stark reality that in many systemic conflicts, some groups are directly materially benefiting from another group's subjugation.
Right, of course. You cannot deliberate away a fundamental conflict of interest where one party's preferred social arrangement basically requires the other party to be kept at the bottom of the ladder.
You really cannot. If you insist on treating a structural injury as a mere misunderstanding that requires more dialogue, you are effectively trapping the injured party.
Wow, yeah.
If you just keep asking the vulnerable group to keep deliberating and keep empathizing while harm continues to accumulate against them, you are letting the dominant party win through the sheer attrition of delay.
Let me throw out an analogy here to see if I'm tracking the real-world application of this.
Mm.
Think of a deeply toxic, exploitative corporate office.
Okay.
The executives are engaged in massive systemic wage theft. The workers are suffering. In this scenario, harmony romanticism is the HR department thinking that one more trust fall retreat or one more mandated listening session in the break room is somehow going to fix the wage theft.
Right.
But it won't. In fact, the executives stealing the wages absolutely love the trust falls. They love the listening sessions.
Why? Because it provides the aesthetic of action without ever threatening their actual power.
Exactly. Yeah. It looks like the company is doing the work while the actual power dynamic remains completely untouched. The workers get a pizza party and a chance to share their feelings, and the executives get to keep the stolen wages.
That's a perfect example.
That's harmony romanticism.
Right.
It creates this false symmetry where the oppressor and the oppressed are just two equal parties who need to communicate better.
That really captures the insidious nature of it perfectly. It weaponizes the language of peace to basically maintain the status quo. Now, the opposite failure state, the second trap in the healing domination dilemma, is what the text calls therapeutic authoritarianism.
Just that phrase alone sounds incredibly dystopian.
Well, it is the darker side of the coin. Therapeutic authoritarianism occurs when a ruling power decides that society is sick and explicitly equates their own preferred political order with societal health.
Okay.
Once they make that equation, the logical next step is horrifying. They identify any political opposition, any dissent, or any marginalized group as a disease or a pathology.
So it's no longer a political disagreement, it's a public health crisis.
Exactly. They claim an exceptional, almost medical authority to treat the social body. And as you know, when you are treating a disease, you don't need to consult the disease about the treatment plan.
Right, you just eradicate it.
Yes. You bypass public justification, you bypass democratic debate, and you use sheer force to excise the sickness.
Going back to that toxic office analogy, therapeutic authoritarianism isn't the HR department planning a trust fall. It's the CEO sending out a company-wide memo declaring that anyone asking for a living wage is a cultural cancer. Is destroying the health of the corporate family.
Right.
And therefore, For the survival of the organism, they must be immediately excised by corporate security.
Yes. You recode dissent as biological contagion. And what is truly fascinating about the healing domination dilemma is that the author points out a massive blind spot that well-meaning people often have. You cannot solve this dilemma just by refusing to use power.
Because doing nothing is still a choice with massive consequences.
Exactly. We often think of non-intervention as neutrality. But in a system where power is already imbalanced, refusing to step in choosing non-intervention actually authorizes domination by default.
Wow.
If a powerful entity is actively crushing a vulnerable one, and the state or the governing authority decides to stay neutral and just watch, the authority isn't actually neutral. It is effectively authorizing the crushing.
Right. It makes sense. If a heavyweight boxer is beating up a kid in the street, and a police officer stands there and says, "I don't want to get involved. I'm being neutral," the officer is essentially granting permission for the violence to continue.
The paper frames this brilliantly. The goal of civilizational healing cannot be the naive passivity of harmony romanticism, nor can it be the tyrannical control of therapeutic authoritarianism. The goal must be what the author terms non-dominating protection.
Non-dominating protection. Using power to stop harm, mm-hmm. but doing it in a highly constrained way so you don't just become a new, unaccountable dictator in the process.
Exactly. You target evidenced mechanisms of harm, you operate strictly under constitutional disciplines, and you always preserve the possibility for your own interventions to be challenged and revised.
But this leads us to a massive practical question. If therapeutic authoritarianism is the trap where we treat our political opponents as diseases, how do we draw a hard, unambiguous line?
Yeah, that's the big question.
How do we prevent society from sliding into tyranny while we are actively trying to heal it? Because history is full of regimes that started with the intention of healing the nation and ended up committing atrocities.
This brings us to the ultimate boundary established in the text. It is the absolute floor of the entire framework, and it's called the anti-pathologization principle.
The anti-pathologization principle. Let's dig deep into this because this feels like the linchpin of the whole paper.
It is the constitutional bedrock. The principle states this: in the pursuit of civilizational healing, a society is fully permitted to diagnose injurious conduct. It can diagnose harmful mechanisms, it can diagnose unjust laws, exploitative economic structures, and violent institutions.
Okay, so behaviors and systems.
Yes, but it must never, under any circumstances, classify persons, populations, identities, cultures, or dissenting groups as diseases, parasites, contaminants, or pathologies whose elimination constitutes a treatment.
I want to repeat that so it really sinks in for you listening. You can target the behavior, you can target the law, you can target the mechanism, but you must never turn the person into the pathology.
That's it. The philosophical shift from judging someone's actions as harmful to judging their actual existence as harmful is the moment a society crosses the event horizon into tyranny.
Right.
To illustrate this, the text uses eugenics and early 20th century racial hygiene movements as the negative constitutional control for this principle.
And just to reiterate our ground rules for you listening, the author is not using eugenics as a hyperbolic insult to throw at modern political parties. This is a forensic look at the mechanics of a historical atrocity.
It is a structural analysis of the absolute extreme. The author uses eugenics to show the historical endpoint of what happens when a state crosses this exact line.
So how did it work structurally?
If we look at the grammar of eugenics, it biologized social problems. Issues like poverty, crime, or social unrest were no longer viewed as failures of policy, education, or economics. They were declared to be genetic contaminants. Identity, rather than conduct, was designated as the root cause of societal illness.
And once you define a human being as a biological contaminant, they lose everything.
They completely lose their standing as human beings with rights. You cannot debate with a virus. You cannot grant due process to a parasite. The intervention becomes bodily, irreversible, and absolute.
It's purification disguised as public health.
Mm-hmm.
And anyone who challenged the eugenics board was just labeled as an enemy of health or, you know, part of the disease themselves.
Exactly. The anti-pathologization principle exists to ensure that any proposed healing mechanism that even begins to sound like that, where a specific category of human is defined as the contaminant, fails instantly. Before we even debate the logistics, the proposal is thrown out.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting, and I'm going to push back on this a bit because I can hear the counter-argument forming. If we have this absolute rule that we can never label any group as a social disease, does that mean the state has to stay completely neutral toward, say, violently organized hate groups?
Mm-hmm.
or fundamentally abusive organizations? Are hands tied? Do we just have to let them operate freely because we aren't allowed to call them a cancer on society?
That is a very common misinterpretation of this kind of boundary, and the text provides a crucial, razor-sharp distinction to address it.
Okay.
The anti-pathologization principle is not a mandate for pacifism or state neutrality. The distinction is between judging conduct and judging personhood. We can absolutely constrain harmful ideologies. We can prohibit violent conduct with the full force of the law. We can dismantle abusive institutions piece by piece.
So where exactly is the line drawn between stopping a hate group and becoming a therapeutic authoritarian?
The line is crossed when you move from targeting the mechanism of harm to dehumanizing the person involved. The text gives a robust test for this boundary.
What's the test?
First, is the state's intervention tied to specific, provable conduct or institutional function? And second, this is the defining metric. If an individual leaves the harmful group, or if they cease the harmful conduct, do they instantly retain their full human rights and due process?
I see the mechanism now.
Yeah.
So if the state arrests a member of a hate group for violent incitement, the state is punishing the conduct. But that person still gets a defense lawyer. They still have basic human rights while sitting in a jail cell.
Yes.
They are protected against cruel and unusual punishment. And when their sentence is up, they are permitted to rejoin society.
Precisely. You destroy the mechanism of harm, in this case, the organized violence and incitement, but you do not destroy the humanity of the person.
Right.
An abusive organization can be legally dismantled, its assets seized, its leaders imprisoned for their actions. But the adherents do not become biological contaminants. They remain human beings, subject to the law, capable of agency and change. You constrain the ideology without declaring the adherent a diseased entity that must be purged from the gene pool.
That makes a ton of sense. It's a very heavy, sturdy floor to build a society on. Everyone retains equal human standing no matter what they've done. No one is a parasite.
Exactly.
But if everyone is human and everyone has equal standing, that brings up a really thorny practical issue. Does that mean every single opinion or claim they bring to the public square is equally valid?
Mm-hmm.
If we have to respect everyone's humanity, do we have to give everyone's ideas equal weight when we are trying to set policy?
If we connect this to the bigger picture of why our current institutions feel so paralyzed, this is exactly where modern democratic processes often fail. The text introduces a concept called the person claim distinction.
Okay.
The golden rule here is, persons are equal. Claims are not automatically symmetrical.
Persons are equal. Claims are not. That feels like something you could engrave over the door of a courthouse.
It is essential for a functioning society. Just because you have equal moral and legal standing as a human being does not mean your specific claim has equal normative weight in a given situation. The paper gives stark examples. A person's democratic right to participate in political life does not make a claim advocating for racial exclusion equivalent to a claim advocating for equal citizenship. Those claims are not symmetrical.
Oh, absolutely.
An elected official authority to decide a policy doesn't make their personal anecdotal beliefs superior to a transparent, rigorously peer-reviewed scientific assessment.
We run into so much trouble because we assume that treating people equally means treating their arguments equally, even when one argument is entirely divorced from reality or explicitly designed to harm others.
Yeah.
We make these massive category errors when we try to resolve conflicts.
We do. And to help untangle this, the paper actually identifies 8 distinct dimensions of conflict. This is one of the most useful diagnostic tools in the entire text. People constantly mistake one type of conflict for another, and they apply the wrong resolution tool as a result.
Let's actually walk through all 8 of those dimensions, because I think for you listening, this is a phenomenal framework for how you might consume the news tonight or even analyze an argument at your workplace.
Certainly. The 8 dimensions are epistemic, interpretive, value, interest, rights, domination, historical repair, and security.
Okay, let's break them down. An epistemic conflict.
Yeah.
That's fundamentally about facts, right? What is true? What is false? What causes what? Is it raining outside? Is an epistemic question. You resolve that with inquiry, evidence, and science.
Yes. You look out the window.
Right.
The second is interpretive. This is a conflict over what a rule, a law, or a text actually means in a specific context. Does this old law apply to this new technology that requires hermeneutics, legal analysis, and judges?
The third is value conflict. This is about what priorities or ways of life should prevail. Like, should we prioritize liberty over collective security?
And you resolve value conflicts through democratic deliberation, persuasion, and ultimately elections.
Got it.
The fourth is interest conflict. This is about distribution.
Yeah.
Who gains, who loses, who pays the taxes, where does the budget go? You resolve that through negotiation, bargaining, and compromise.
The fifth is a rights conflict. This is about protected claims that constrain ordinary politics. Does the government have the right to search my house without a warrant? You can't just bargain over that. That requires adjudication in constitutional courts.
Exactly. The sixth is domination. This is a conflict over structural subjugation, where one group holds unaccountable power over another, a master-slave dynamic or a colonial occupation.
You definitely can't solve that with a budget meeting.
No, you cannot solve this with a simple election or a budget negotiation. It requires structural transformation and often counterpower.
Seventh is historical repair. How do we address the enduring legacies of past injuries? Stolen land, systemic disenfranchisement. That requires mechanisms of transitional justice and material restitution.
And finally, security. This is a conflict involving an immediate existential threat to life or bodily integrity. That requires protective constraint and self-defense.
So the paper warns against making a category error by using the wrong tool for the wrong dimension of conflict.
Exactly. You cannot use an election to settle an epistemic conflict. Let's say there is a new virus. Voting on whether the virus exists or voting on its transmission rate doesn't change the biological reality of the virus. Trying to settle a scientific fact through a political poll is an epistemic laundering error.
Or treating a fundamental rights violation like a simple interest conflict, where we just need to find a compromise. If a group is demanding the right to exist freely and another group is demanding their eradication, you don't compromise by saying, okay, we'll only eradicate half of you.
Right, that's absurd.
You cannot meet in the middle on a fundamental human right.
That is the precise danger. But the most pervasive and damaging category error the paper highlights is something called stakeholder symmetry.
That's stakeholder symmetry. This happens in corporate settings and government policy all the time, right?
Yeah.
It is the default setting for many democratic processes because it mimics fairness. Stakeholder symmetry is when a process gives equal formal voting power, equal microphone time, and equal process roles to actors who have vastly unequal power or actors who have massive documented conflicts of interest regarding the outcome.
I love how we can visualize this. It's like letting a wolf have an equal vote with a flock of sheep on what's for dinner and doing it in the name of procedural fairness.
Yes.
You put the wolf and the sheep at the same stakeholder table. You give them each a name tent and a microphone, and you pretend it's a balanced democratic process.
And by doing so, you merely increase the legitimacy of the dominant actor, the wolf, without redistributing any actual control or safety to the vulnerable party. You give the wolf the veneer of democratic consensus.
So how do we avoid that trap without violating the rule that everyone gets a say?
To illustrate how to construct a legitimate asymmetry, the text provides a fascinating real-world case study, Article 5.3 of the World Health Organization's Framework Convention on Tobacco Control.
The WHO and tobacco control. How does international health policy handle the wolf at the table?
Well, the WHO has an explicit, legally binding protocol that severely limits the tobacco industry's participation in setting public health policy. They have a documented evidentiary finding that there is a fundamental, irreconcilable conflict of interest between the commercial goals of the tobacco industry, which is to sell more cigarettes and maximize profit, and the public health goal of reducing smoking and saving lives.
I mean, logically, that seems incredibly obvious. Of course the cigarette company wants to sell cigarettes.
It is obvious, but think about how it functions structurally under this framework. The WHO does not declare tobacco executives to be subhuman. They do not pathologize them as biological contaminants.
Right.
They don't strip them of their ordinary legal rights, their right to a fair trial, or their right to bodily autonomy.
Right. They aren't thrown in a dungeon. They're still citizens.
What the WHO simply says is this. Because of this documented structural conflict of interest, your claims in this specific policy arena are not symmetrical to the claims of independent public health advocates.
Makes sense.
Therefore, you do not get a seat at the policymaking table. You do not get to co-author the health regulations that will govern your own product.
They retain their personhood, they keep their baseline legal rights, but they lose their regulatory privilege because their specific claim is categorically invalid for that specific function.
Exactly.
It's like a referee in a basketball game. If the referee has a massive bet on one of the teams, You don't execute the referee. You just don't let them officiate that game. Their claim to impartiality is invalid.
That is an excellent analogy. It justifies participation asymmetry without violating the anti-pathologization principle. It is a targeted constraint on a mechanism of harm.
Okay, so we have the person claim distinction.
Mm-hmm.
We can limit bad faith claims, and we can legally keep the wolves away from the sheep's policy table.
Yeah.
But eventually, someone has to enforce these rules.
Yes, they do.
When a conflict refuses to be solved by policy papers and stakeholder exclusions, when do we stop debating, stop holding meetings, and start using actual state power coercion to force a change?
This transition is the beating heart of the paper. It describes the dangerous but necessary shift from what it calls regime first, which is legitimate contestation, to regime third, which is protective constraint.
Regime for regime the second. Let's map those out.
Regime first is where we normally want society to reside. Legitimate contestation. This includes debate, peaceful protest, labor strikes, collective bargaining, voting, and litigation. Pluralism.
The healthy stuff.
Right. It is a healthy, dynamic state. It reviews new information, it tests the authority of leaders, and it allows society to evolve. But regime first has a strict limit. The presumption that we should keep a conflict open and keep debating only applies as long as doing so doesn't violate a substantive floor.
That's a substantive floor. What exactly is that floor made of? What happens when we break through it?
The substantive floor is composed of equal standing, bodily integrity, and basic human rights. If keeping the debate going means that a vulnerable group is actively subjected to serious domination, rights violations, or preventable physical harm, then the debate itself is no longer legitimate.
Because if one side can indefinitely externalize actual harm onto the other side while insisting that the debate continue, the debate is just a smokescreen for domination.
Precisely. At that boundary, when the floor is breached, the legitimate authority has the right and the duty to step in with force. This is regime the second, protective constraint.
Okay.
To illustrate the extreme tension of this transition, the text uses a very famous historical anchor, the 1957 Little Rock desegregation crisis.
Oh, this is a powerful and very visceral example.
Okay.
Walk us through how Dr. Saheli's paper analyzes the mechanics of Little Rock.
Let's establish the context. In 1954, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled unanimously in Brown v. Board of Education that state-enforced racial segregation in public schools violated the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution. It was the law of the land. But 3 years later, in 1957, the state government of Arkansas, led by Governor Orville Phobos, along with massive, furious local mobs, actively obstructed the integration of Central High School in Little Rock.
Right. They deployed the state National Guard, ironically, to keep 9 black students, the Little Rock 9, from entering the building. They used public power and the explicit threat of mob violence to block constitutional rights.
Yes. And eventually, President Dwight D. Eisenhower federalized the Arkansas National Guard and sent in the 101st Airborne Division Active Duty Federal Military Troops to physically escort the students inside and enforce the court order.
It's one of the most iconic moments in American civil rights history. But how does the paper view the arguments being made at the time?
The paper focuses on the argument for delay that the state officials were making. The governor and local leaders argued that because there was so much local hostility, so much anger and potential disorder, they needed to postpone desegregation.
They needed more time.
Exactly. They argued that forcing it would tear the community apart. Essentially, they were demanding to keep the conflict in regime. They wanted to let the local democratic process work it out slowly over time on their own schedule.
I'm going to play devil's advocate here to channel what a critic might say. Shouldn't a democracy let local people vote on how their own local schools are run? Isn't sending in federal paratroopers with fixed bayonets a form of central tyranny against the local population?
That is the exact tension the paper addresses, and it resolves it by introducing a framework called dual error governance.
Dual error governance, meaning there are two ways to fail.
Right. Whenever an authority makes a policy choice in a conflict, they risk two types of errors, a false positive and a false negative, over constraint versus under constraint.
Okay.
In the Little Rock scenario, a false positive would be the federal government intervening unnecessarily, acting like a tyrant over a peaceful administrative local dispute. But we have to look at the alternative. What was the false negative? The error of non-intervention.
The error of doing nothing. The error of letting the mob have its way.
If the federal government had done nothing, if they had accepted the governor's argument for delay and allowed the local mob to decide the timeline for integration, it would have established a horrifying precedent.
Oh, yeah.
It would have meant that fundamental constitutional rights are contingent on the permission and the comfort level of an angry mob. The Supreme Court later explicitly ruled in a related case, Cooper v. Aaron, that you cannot suspend constitutional rights just because the local population is hostile to them.
So by demanding a delay, by asking for more time to deliberate,
mm-hmm.
the local government was actually exercising dominating power over the black students.
Mm-hmm.
Delay wasn't a neutral pause for reflection. Delay was an act of violence. It was harmony romanticism weaponized by a mob.
Exactly. Non-intervention in that moment would have been a catastrophic failure to protect the substantive floor. Therefore, the transition to regime the second, using the overwhelming coercive force of federal troops, was entirely justified. The democratic pedigree of the local mob, the fact that they were the local majority, was totally insufficient because their local process was explicitly designed to destroy the standing and rights of the minority students.
So we established that the government absolutely has the right and the duty to step in with force to protect the vulnerable. The substantive floor must be defended. But that introduces a terrifying new problem.
It does.
Once we authorize the state to use coercion, how do we guarantee that the cure, the federal troops, the state intervention, doesn't become worse than the disease? How do we stop the protector from just deciding to stay in power forever and becoming a new dictator?
This is the eternal problem of political philosophy. How do you guard the guards? The paper addresses this with a rigorous standard called the Least Dominating Effective Means Principle, abbreviated as LDME.
LDME, Least Dominating Effective Means. Let's break that down.
When an authority intervenes to stop a harm, they have a menu of options. The LDME principle dictates that they must choose the option that creates the least amount of uncontrolled power and places the smallest possible burden on human agency.
Okay, so you always pick the gentlest option first. You start with a polite letter, then a fine, then maybe a stern warning.
Ah, no. And that is the most critical distinction in this principle. It is not just the least dominating means. It is the least dominating effective means.
Effective. It actually has to work.
You only compare options that will actually end the injury in the required time frame. You do not pick a weak symbolic intervention just because it appears less coercive if it doesn't actually stop the harm.
Let me try an analogy here. It's nest like a surgeon deciding how to remove a dangerous, fast-growing tumor.
Mm.
You obviously want to make the smallest incision possible.
Of course.
That's the least dominating intervention on the patient's body, because you don't want to cut them wide open unnecessarily and cause massive trauma. But if a tiny incision and a Band-Aid won't actually let you reach and cure the cancer, you don't use it just because it's less invasive.
Yeah.
You must use the smallest tool that actually gets the whole job done. If it requires a massive open surgery with a scalpel, to save the patient's life, you use the scalpel.
That is a phenomenal analogy. If the gentle option allows the tumor to kill the patient, it is not an effective means. And to ensure that the political scalpel is used correctly and not just wielded recklessly by power-hungry leaders, the text requires decision makers to pass what it calls a legitimate constraint test. It is a 20-question audit.
20 questions? That sounds like an intense bureaucratic hurdle. What kind of questions are we talking about?
Well, the test is organized into specific modules designed to create a transparent public record of justification before or during the use of force. Let's look at a few of the modules. Under the authority module, it asks, does the intervening actor possess actual lawful competence, or are they just using a corrective purpose as a convenient excuse to seize extra legal power?
Basically, are you the actual surgeon, or are you just a guy with a knife claiming you want to help?
Precisely. Under the distribution module, it asks a profound ethical question. Who bears the costs and risks of this intervention? Are marginalized groups bearing the burden of precaution for others? If a policy causes economic fallout, who loses their jobs?
That's vital. We often implement massive structural fixes without realizing the collateral damage falls entirely on the poorest people.
And under the remedy and revision modules, it asks, if this intervention is misused, what is the path for independent complaint? And what are the predefined triggers that will end the coercion?
So it's not just a blank check to use force forever. It's a highly structured, continuous audit to make sure the force remains accountable and temporary. But even with all of that rigor coercion, isn't a magic wand, is it? Let's actually look back at the Little Rock example. The troops went in, they were effective at breaking the mob, but did it instantly heal the society?
Little Rock is the perfect historical mirror to show the severe limits of coercion. The federal intervention passed the core elements of the constraint test clearly. The federal executive used lawful constitutional authority to stop the documented obstruction of fundamental rights. It was the least dominating effective means to get the students through the door.
Right.
However, the text points out that the intervention, by its very nature, was deeply insufficient.
Right. The troops got the kids into the school building, but military escorts can't force a school to actually educate those kids safely.
Exactly. The armed troops enabled physical attendance, but they could not stop the insidious daily harassment inside the halls when the soldiers turned their backs. They couldn't mandate friendship or true integration, and they certainly didn't prevent what became known as the lost year.
The lost year. Explain what happened there, because it is shocking how far the resistance went.
The following academic year, rather than comply with the ongoing integration order, Governor Faubus and the state legislature simply closed all the public high schools in Little Rock. They shut the entire system down. Thousands of students, black and white, were locked out of their education for a full year.
They literally nuked their own public education system just to avoid sitting in the same classroom as black students. It's astonishing.
It demonstrates the paper's thesis perfectly. Coercion, while absolutely undeniably necessary to stop the immediate mechanism of violent harm, cannot heal a society. It can enforce a boundary. It can stop the bleeding. But it cannot force a society to learn, to adapt, or to reconcile.
Okay, so this entirely covers top-down power. The federal government forcing a rogue state to comply. The state enforcing laws on citizens. But what about bottom-up power? What happens when the vulnerable people are the ones who have to use coercion or physical refusal against the state itself? Because history shows us that sometimes the law itself is the mechanism of domination.
The paper dedicates a significant section to exactly this dynamic. It explores how ordinary, peaceful compliance with an unjust law can sometimes legitimize systemic domination. In those cases, civil disobedience, labor strikes, blockades, and physical refusal become necessary mechanisms of civilizational healing.
So it works both ways.
Right. It is not just about official state coercion. Counterpower is also a vital, legitimate tool.
Do we have a case study for this bottom-up resistance in the text?
We do. The text features a modern and highly influential case, the Sarayaku struggle in Ecuador.
The Sarayaku case. Let's paint the picture of what happened there.
In the 1990s and early 2000s, the national state of Ecuador authorized a foreign oil consortium to conduct petroleum exploration in the Amazon block. This block covered the ancestral territory of the Quechua indigenous people of Sarayaku. The state granted these concessions without conducting any appropriate, legally mandated prior consultation with the Sarayaku people.
So the state just signs a contract in the capital city and hands over indigenous land to an oil company.
Yes. And the company entered the territory with military backing. They opened seismic lines through the jungle. They destroyed crops. And they actually buried over a ton of high-powered pentoite explosives across Sarayaku land for seismic testing.
They buried explosives in their forests, around their homes. Without asking.
It's an existential threat to their lives, their ecosystem, and their cultural survival. In response, the Sarayaku people did not just write a letter, they flatly refused entry. They physically blockaded the rivers, they mobilized their community to physically resist the intrusion, and simultaneously they pursued relentless domestic and international legal remedies. Eventually, in 2012, after a massive struggle, the Inter-American Court of Human Rights ruled decisively in their favor. The court found that the state violated their right to consultation, their communal property, and put their lives and physical integrity at grave risk.
Okay, I have to jump in here because I know what a skeptical listener might be thinking right now. This sounds structurally identical to the Little Rock case, but in reverse.
Let's hear it.
Let's look at it. At Little Rock, a local authority, the state of Arkansas, refused a central mandate from the federal government. And the paper says Arkansas was wrong, their refusal was bad. Here, a local authority, the indigenous people of Sarayaku, refuses a central mandate from the state of Ecuador. And the paper says Sarayaku is right, their refusal was good. How do we know the difference without just picking favorites based on who we sympathize with more?
That is the most rigorous analytical test in the section of the paper. Dr. Sakili explicitly addresses this apparent contradiction. You cannot judge a movement of refusal or resistance merely by looking at its surface aesthetics. Both Arkansas and Sarayaku resisted central authority, both mobilized local people. To tell the difference objectively, the text provides two specific axes of evaluation.
The two axes of refusal, let's hear them.
The first axis is the authority relation. You have to ask, is the central demand actually lawful and jurisdictionally valid in the first place?
Okay, so checking the paperwork.
Right. In Little Rock, the federal demand was enforcing a clearly established supreme constitutional right to equal protection. The central order was valid. In Ecuador, the state presumed it had exclusive, unchecked jurisdiction to authorize resource extraction on indigenous territory without consent, completely ignoring binding international law regarding indigenous jurisdiction and legal plurality. The underlying demand from the state was fundamentally defective.
So Axis 1, was the original order even legal? Arkansas violated a valid constitutional order. Ecuador issued an invalid dominating order. That's a huge distinction.
Exactly. The second axis is external consequences, you must ask. Does the act of refusal protect life, or does it deliberately harm third parties? Sarayaku was a protective refusal. They were trying to stop live explosives from destroying their physical lives, their environment, and their culture.
And Arkansas.
Arkansas was a dominating refusal. They were actively attempting to preserve a system of racial subjugation and inflict profound harm on innocent Black students.
That makes the distinction incredibly sharp. You don't just pick favorites. You analyze the underlying authority structure and the external consequences of the action. You audit the power being used.
And importantly, the paper applies the exact same legitimate constraint test to resistance movements that it applies to the state.
Oh, really?
Yes. Just because a group is marginalized doesn't give them a moral blank check to do whatever they want. A resistance movement or a refusal can still be deemed illegitimate if it imposes serious, unjustified harm on vulnerable third parties, or if it uses completely disproportionate, indiscriminate violence. The symmetry of the framework is analytical, not moral. Everyone's power gets audited.
I love that. The rules of power apply to everyone, top to bottom. So whether the conflict is settled by federal troops integrating a high school or international courts protecting an Amazonian forest, stopping the bad behavior is really only half the battle. Once the dust settles, once the explosives are dug up or the school doors are integrated, how do you actually fix the massive damage that was left behind?
But that transition brings us to the final major movement of the paper, what it calls Regime the Third, the Matrix of Repair. The core question here is profound, and we rarely ask it. If the harmful mechanism stopped completely today, what injury would still remain tomorrow?
If the harm stops, what is left? The text refers to this as distinguishing between cessation and repair.
Yes. In politics, we almost always confuse the two. We think that stopping the harm is the exact same thing as fixing the damage. The text uses a devastating historical case study to illustrate the immense difference between the two. Minamata disease in Japan.
Minamata. I've heard of this in environmental history classes. It was industrial poisoning on a massive scale, right?
It was one of the most tragic corporate disasters of the 20th century. For decades, beginning in the 1930s, a massive chemical corporation called Chiso discharged industrial wastewater heavily contaminated with methylmercury directly into Minamata Bay. This highly toxic mercury bioaccumulated in the local fish and shellfish, which was the staple diet and economic lifeblood of the local population.
And it caused unimaginable suffering.
Horrific neurological damage. Numbness, loss of vision, severe congenital defects in infants, agonizing deaths. Initially, they didn't know what it was. It was officially identified as a disease related to the local environment in 1956. But because of corporate obfuscation and government collusion, the Japanese government didn't officially conclude the cause, the Chiso factory, until 1968.
That is 12 years of continued daily exposure, death, and official denial after they already suspected what was happening.
Yes. Eventually, through immense public pressure and litigation, the discharge of mercury was permanently stopped. But here is the lesson the paper draws from it. Stopping the discharge, the cessation, did not heal the neurological damage of the victims.
Right.
It didn't clear the toxic sediment that had settled at the bottom of the bay. It didn't instantly restore the lost fishing livelihoods, and it didn't repair the intense social stigma the victims faced from neighboring towns.
Okay, so what does this all mean for our framework? Let me use a really grounded analogy here. Let's say you're asleep in your house, and a massive storm blows a tree onto your roof, smashing a huge hole in it. The rain is pouring in, ruining everything.
A nightmare scenario.
Stopping the rain, putting a tarp over the hole so no more water comes in, is cessation.
Yeah.
It's vital. You have to stop the immediate mechanism of harm. But putting a tarp over the hole does not replace your ruined carpets. It doesn't fix the cracked foundation. It doesn't replace the family photos that were destroyed.
That is an excellent way to conceptualize it. Putting up the tarp is regime the second, protective constraint. Fixing the house, replacing the carpet, and rebuilding the foundation is regime the third, repair. And to organize how we actually go about rebuilding the social house, the text details a massive framework called the two-axis repair architecture.
The matrix of repair. How exactly does this grid work?
The first axis of the matrix relies on the five established forms of reparation recognized by the United Nations and international law. They are restitution, compensation, rehabilitation, satisfaction, and guarantees of non-repetition.
Let's define those in real terms so we're all on the same page. Restitution.
Restitution means restoring what was actually lost, returning the victim to their original state as much as possible, returning stolen land, restoring political liberty, or giving someone their job back after they were unjustly fired.
Compensation.
This is financial, paying for economically assessable damage, physical harm, medical bills, or lost opportunity and wages.
Rehabilitation.
This is care. Providing long-term medical, psychological, legal, and social services to heal the mind and body.
Satisfaction. This one sounds a bit vague.
It is more symbolic, but it is deeply vital for social trust. It includes establishing the objective truth, public acknowledgement of the harm, official apologies, judicial sanctions against the perpetrators, and building commemorations or memorials.
And finally, guarantees of non-repetition.
Reforming the institutions, rewriting the laws, and changing the practices to ensure the harm can literally never happen again.
Okay, so those five forms make up the first axis. What is the second axis of the matrix?
The second axis is about the depth of the intervention. It asks, how deep into the social structure does this reparation actually go? The four depths are consequential, relational, structural generative, and regenerative.
Consequential means dealing with the immediate surface level fallout, right?
Yes. Addressing the specific materialized harm suffered by an individual, paying a single hospital bill.
And relational.
Relational depth addresses standing, dignity, and civic trust, how people view each other across divides. Structural or generative depth goes to the root causes, changing the underlying laws, economic incentives, and power balances that allowed the harm to happen. And regenerative depth is about building future independent capacity that is controlled by the affected people themselves.
So you cross these two axes, you multiply the five forms by the four depths, it creates a 20-cell matrix. Why do we need this complex grid to figure out how to apologize?
Because the matrix acts as a highly sensitive omission detector. It exposes what the text calls symbolic substitution, which is arguably the biggest trap in modern political apologies.
Symbolic substitution.
Symbolic substitution occurs when a government or an institution offers a monument or a public apology, which is a form of satisfaction at a relational depth, when what a community desperately needs is their stolen land returned to them, which is restitution at a structural depth.
Oh, I see it perfectly now. You look at the matrix and say, wait a minute. You check the box for an apology, and maybe you built a nice statue, but the boxes for actually returning our property, compensating our lost wages, and reforming the corrupt police department are completely empty.
Exactly. It prevents institutions from doing the cheapest, most symbolic, photogenic thing and declaring the process repaired. For example, if we look back at Minamata, the Japanese government eventually provided compensation and health care to recognized victims. They issued official recognition and apologies.
But there were gaps.
Massive gaps. If we run that through the matrix, it reveals massive deficits. Many people who suffered mild or atypical symptoms were entirely excluded from official certification through impossibly strict bureaucratic rules, so consequential compensation was incomplete. Furthermore, a formal apology doesn't immediately repair decades of community mistrust and relational stigma. The matrix forces policymakers to look at the entire landscape of the injury.
Knowing what repair looks like is one thing. The matrix maps it out beautifully. But deciding who has to provide it, who actually writes the check, who gives up the land, who has to change their behavior, and how they provide it is where things get incredibly messy, especially when we are talking about historical harms that happened generations ago.
It is arguably the most fraught and explosive part of civilizational healing. This brings us to the text's responsibility architecture.
Because right now, when we try to talk about historical harms or systemic injustice, the public debate almost immediately collapses into two extreme, dead-end opposing slogans.
Yes. Slogan one, I didn't personally do it, therefore I owe absolutely nothing. This perspective completely ignores ongoing systemic effects, inherited wealth, and the continuity of institutions.
Right.
Slogan two, you belong to the wrong demographic group or ancestry, therefore you inherit permanent personal guilt. This perspective confuses civic obligation with moral culpability, and it essentially treats a person's identity as a crime.
Both of those slogans make me want to pull my hair out. They are conversational dead ends that just generate anger. How does the paper solve this?
By breaking the concept of responsibility down into 7 distinct, highly specific justificatory pathways. They are causal, culpability, institutional, beneficiary, capacity, role, and civic responsibility.
7 pathways. Let's walk through these because I think this completely shifts how we can talk about owing a debt to the past without making people feel personally attacked. Let's start with culpability.
Culpability is the most straightforward and the most familiar. It requires intentional harm, active abuse, or gross negligence. If you were the executive who signed the memo ordering the toxic mercury to be dumped into the bay, you are morally and legally culpable. You face direct sanctions and prison.
Okay, but the executive eventually dies. What about institutional responsibility?
This is how we bridge the generations. Institutions, governments, massive corporations, religious orders, universities, they can retain their legal identity, their accumulated assets, and their authority for centuries. The president of a university might not be personally culpable for the university stealing land or exploiting labor 150 years ago.
Right.
But the institution itself still holds the assets generated by that theft. Therefore, the institution bears a continuous duty to repair, regardless of how much the personnel has turned over.
The ledger doesn't just wipe clean because the old CEO retired and someone new took over. What about beneficiary responsibility?
Beneficiary responsibility applies if you are in present possession of a traceable unjust advantage. For example, if you inherited a massive monopoly position in an industry that was built on forced labor, you have a responsibility to return that benefit or contribute proportionately to repair. You do not carry personal guilt for what your ancestors did, but you do not have a moral or legal right to keep stolen goods.
That makes sense. Let's look at capacity and role responsibility before we hit the last one.
Capacity responsibility means that sometimes entities have an obligation to help simply because they have the immense resources to do so, even if they didn't cause the harm. A wealthy neighboring country providing disaster relief, for instance.
And role responsibility?
Role responsibility means that by taking on a specific job, you inherit specific duties. A modern police chief has a role responsibility to root out corruption in the department, even if the corruption started before they were hired.
And the last one I want to highlight, which I think is absolutely brilliant for the average person, is civic responsibility.
Civic responsibility explains why ordinary people who didn't cause a harm, who aren't personally culpable, and who maybe didn't even directly benefit from it, still have an obligation to support repair through their state. When you are a citizen of a continuous polity, you inherit the state's assets, you inherit the roads, the military protection, the Constitution, the national parks, but you also inherit its legal and moral debts.
This solves the guilt problem entirely. I always think of it like this. If I move into a new city tomorrow, I didn't personally pave the roads, but I drive on them. I benefit from them every day. And if a massive bridge in that city, built 50 years before I was born, starts rusting and collapsing, my taxes go to pay to fix it.
Exactly.
I don't feel guilty that the bridge is broken. I'm not a bad person because the steel rusted. But it's my civic duty to fund the repair because I am part of the community that relies on the infrastructure.
That is an excellent, grounded way to understand it. It transforms the conversation from personal inherited blame to prospective public responsibility. To see how these pathways actually work in reality, the text examines 2 massive, world-altering truth and reconciliation commissions, Canada and South Africa.
Let's start with Canada. What was the specific injury there?
The Canadian state and various church institutions engaged in a century-long policy of systematically removing Indigenous children from their families and placing them in what were called Indian residential schools. The explicit documented goal of this policy was to suppress Indigenous language, culture, and familial bonds, effectively a forced assimilation policy.
It was horrific.
Yes. It caused immense intergenerational trauma, widespread physical and sexual abuse, and damaged the political relationship profoundly.
And how did the Canadian Truth and Reconciliation Commission handle assigning responsibility for a century of harm?
They utilized multiple pathways simultaneously. They issued 94 calls to action. And crucially, they didn't just blame the government as a monolith. They located responsibility across specific churches, professional medical associations, educational systems, law enforcement, and museums.
So hitting all the institutions.
Yes. They recognized institutional continuity. The specific churches and government departments involved still exist today. They activated role responsibility, saying modern educators have a duty to change the curriculum. And they utilize civic responsibility to call on all Canadians, old and new, to support the structural changes.
The matrix in action. They didn't just write a single check. They looked at the structural and generative depths of the harm.
They attempted to lay the groundwork for it. Though, as the text notes through critical Indigenous scholarship, issuing a call to action is not the same as implementing it. And there is a massive risk in Canada of using the soft language of healing and closure to individualize what is actually a massive structural nation-to-nation jurisdictional issue. Paying compensation doesn't automatically fix the underlying colonial legal relationship regarding land and sovereignty.
Which brings us perfectly to South Africa and the transition from apartheid.
The South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission is a cornerstone of global transitional justice. It faced a unique, almost impossible constraint. A negotiated transition from a regime of systematic, brutal state violence to a democracy without triggering a civil war. They couldn't prosecute everyone, the country's institutions and military would have violently rebelled, so they established a system of conditional amnesty.
Amnesty traded for truth.
Yes. If a perpetrator came forward and made full public disclosure of all relevant facts regarding their politically motivated crimes, they could receive amnesty from prosecution. The text highlights a very specific, deeply controversial feature of this process to establish its final, crucial rule of civilizational healing.
What is this final rule?
The non-compulsory reconciliation principle.
Non-compulsory reconciliation, meaning you cannot force people to make up.
Precisely. The South African TRC required objective truth for amnesty. It did not require remorse from the perpetrator, though many showed it was not legally required. And more importantly, it did not require forgiveness from the victim.
Let me make sure I understand the weight of this. A victim of horrific state violence could sit in that hearing room, listen to the absolute truth of what happened to their family, watch the perpetrator receive full legal amnesty, and completely refuse to forgive them, refuse to shake their hand, and the process still functioned legally.
Yes, a state can mandate financial repair. It can mandate structural institutional reform. It can mandate lawful coexistence, meaning you cannot physically attack each other anymore. But the state can never demand forgiveness or emotional closure from the victims as the required price of justice.
That is profound. It entirely removes the emotional burden from the shoulders of the victim.
Exactly. Too often, in the name of national unity, victims are heavily pressured to publicly forgive their abusers, to perform this grand emotional reconciliation so that the rest of society can feel good about itself and move on. The text says absolutely no. Truth is not compensation. National political reconciliation is not interpersonal forgiveness. The state owes you reliable institutions, restitution, and protection. You, as a victim, do not owe the state your emotional closure in return.
Applying that back to Canada, reconciliation cannot be a tool used by the state to force Indigenous peoples to accept a subordinate colonial relationship just because a financial settlement was paid and a prime minister read an apology.
Right. A political relationship must be negotiated with respect for distinct rights and jurisdiction. It cannot be imposed as a mandatory nationwide therapy session where the injured party is forced to say, "I forgive you."
This brings us to the ultimate, somewhat jarring realization of what civilizational healing actually looks like in practice. It's not necessarily a happy, warm ending. It's just a functional one. Let me try to recap the massive journey we've just been on through this paper.
Please do synthesize it for us.
The paper outlines three major movements for a broken society. First, protect persons. We establish the anti-pathologization principle as our absolute floor. We never, ever turn our opponents or marginalized groups into a disease or a parasite to be eliminated. We target conduct, never humanity.
Second, constrain injurious mechanisms. When harmony romanticism fails and debate just becomes a cover for domination, we step in with force. But we use the least dominating effective means, guided by the dual error governance framework, to make sure we aren't just creating a new tyrant.
Spot on.
And third, repair the enduring consequences. We use the matrix of repair to fix both the immediate damage and the root structures. We assign responsibility through civic and institutional duty, avoiding the trap of inherited guilt. And we do all this while preserving the right for everyone to challenge the new system. That is an excellent comprehensive distillation of Dr. Sakali's architecture.
But before we go, I want to leave the listener with something to chew on, something the text brings up near the very end, but leaves open as a lingering question.
Yes. There is a final, deeply provocative thought that emerges from this entire framework. Imagine a society that follows this blueprint perfectly. They successfully build perfect, non-dominating institutions. They pay out perfect matrix-level material reparations. They ensure absolute, undeniable, lawful coexistence. No one's rights are violated, ever.
It sounds like a perfect political utopia.
But imagine that in this perfectly just society, the citizens fundamentally refuse to culturally or emotionally identify with one another. They live side by side, they respect the laws perfectly, they do not harm each other, but they possess not a single ounce of shared affection. They don't like each other, they don't share a historical narrative, and they don't want to.
They just coexist, lawfully, functionally, but completely coldly.
The question the text leaves us to ponder is this. Is a society that functions perfectly, with total material justice but without an ounce of shared affection, a healed society? Or is it just a highly managed permanent truce? Can a civilization actually survive on reliable institutions and reciprocal restraint alone? Or is some deeper affective solidarity, some actual love for your neighbor, empirically necessary for human survival in the long run?
That is a staggering question. Is justice enough, or do we actually have to love each other to survive?
The framework ensures justice, it builds the house, it leaves the question of love entirely to the people living inside it.
Wow. Thank you for joining me on this incredibly deep dive. We started by talking about the paralyzing feeling of a polarized society, of looking at a diagnostic landscape that is completely murky and overwhelming. Hopefully, this framework, separating the person from their claim, targeting the mechanism of harm instead of the human, demanding structural repair instead of settling for symbolic apologies, gives you a powerful new lens to view the world. I invite you to look closely at the conflicts in your own communities, your own workplaces, and your own local governments through this architecture. Maybe the societal x-ray machine isn't completely broken after all. We just needed to learn how to read the scans. Take care, everyone.